Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past five shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Spanish National Radio, Sputnik Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes presents reports on the protest in England over the murder of Sarah Everard. A police officer has been charged for her kidnapping and murder. The world arms trade has stabilized over the past 5 years, though sales from the United States to 96 countries increased by 37%. France and Germany also saw gains in war profits. Spanish National Radio.
In England, protests over the murder of Sarah Everard as she was walking home from a friend's house on March 3rd continue. The 33-year-old woman disappeared around 9:30 that evening in South London. Her remains were found some miles away in Kent, and a servicing police officer, Wayne Cousins, has been charged with her kidnap and murder. On Saturday, demonstrators had a vigil for Sarah Everard at Chapin Common in South London, near the place where she'd been abducted. The unauthorized event drew a crowd of several thousand men and women who'd assembled peacefully until the police used their sticks, pushed, and forcibly moved the demonstrators. Demonstrators gathered again on Sunday to protest against the police response and for the right of women to feel safe on the streets. Protesters marched from the headquarters of the London Police to Parliament Square. Police kept a distance and allowed the march and speeches to go ahead. The world's arms trade has stabilized over the past 5 years following years of rises, due mostly to the drop in Russian and Chinese exports. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, published its report showing that the total volume of weapons sales fell 0.5% between the 2011 to 2015 and 2016 to 2020 periods. It was the first decrease in nearly two decades, and that despite notable increases in sales by the top three armament manufacturers, led by the United States, with a 37% increase in sales during this period. The U.S., France, and Germany, three of the world's biggest exporters, increased deliveries. However, according to SIPRI, falls in exports from the Russian and Chinese offset the rise. The report added that it was still too early to determine whether the period of rapid growth in arms sales over the past 20 years has truly ended. The economic impact of COVID-19 could make itself felt in the next period. The U.S. sold weapons to 96 countries, more than half of them located in the Middle East. It increased sales by 15% and widened the gap with Russia, which suffered a 22% drop in its operations with India. Russia is still the second largest seller, with 20% of the total.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from her program called Panorama on Radio Exterior de España, or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. Beginning March 28, Spain will return to shortwave from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time at 17855 and 11940. Again, that begins March 28th. Next, Sputnik Radio. Afshin Ratansi spoke with Miami-based youth climate activist John Paul Mejia of the Sunrise Movement. He discusses why environmentalists are demanding that the Line 3 crude oil pipeline be shut down, The encroachment of many of these fossil fuel pipelines on indigenous peoples' rights, why all future permits for oil and gas pipelines should be denied, and why Biden needs to stick to his promises of a green future. The 19-year-old says the United States needs to abandon cynicism and instead wage militant optimism. Sputnik Radio.
We knew Joe Biden was for fracking, but did we know how much he would support fossil fuel pipelines? As violence and demonstrations continue against the $8 billion Line 3 project in Minnesota, let's go straight to Philadelphia to speak to the Sunrise Movement's John Paul Mejia. I thought everyone loved Joe Biden for canceling Keystone XL.
Right now, we're really battling with what it is that Joe Biden was elected on. We know that youth voter turnout and voters of color came out in historic droves this year to give Joe Biden and Kamala Harris the victory on their ticket. And the reason that they came out is because they were electing these leaders on a bold mandate for action on climate, COVID, and the economy. And our group, Sunrise Movement, had huge influence on Joe Biden's climate plan, introducing things like a just transition and making all of the deadlines for decarbonization way more ambitious than they first were. But another key element that we introduced into these plans was the aspect of climate justice and upholding indigenous sovereignty in the process of dealing with climate change. And we know that at this moment, there cannot be any new fossil fuel developments. And more so, fossil fuel developments that are unjust. We know that the Keystone XL pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Line 3 in Minnesota are all encroaching upon indigenous rights. And we would hate to see Joe Biden go back on his campaign promises of not upholding indigenous sovereignty. And we are closely allied with our movement partners and water protectors defending these indigenous lands on Line 3.
Yeah, there's been a lot of violence, a lot of arrests there. But Enbridge says it'll create fewer disruptions to landowners and the environment. And this is an Obama-era project supposed to help the environment, so its supporters say.
Right. And I think that when we talk about the authority to say such things, we really shouldn't be concentrating on a corporation, but rather the people who have stewarded and owned this land for centuries. Those are the voices that we should be listening to. And given the protests and actions that are happening right now around Line 3, we should really, really hone in on the authority of indigenous peoples on this land and listen less to the profits of a corporation. All oil and gas pollutes communities, period. All pipelines leak. That's why this one is being built, because they have a dilapidated old one that they're looking to do nothing with. And it's not about where the oil comes from or the mode of transportation. We should be building tubes and pipelines in order to transport clean water to communities, not to break record-shattering oil production and create profits for a few people. So it's crystal clear the moral integrity with which we should be looking at the developments of Line 3 right now and really hold Joe Biden's feet to the fire and all the promises that were made. Biden was never the dream candidate of young people or people of color. He has, to say the least, dubious record on the aspect of racial justice and many issues that are controversial in his presidency now. But Biden actually and his team made the call to us to step up his climate plan. And that's what we were ready to do. We knew that the ball was in our court to really end the reign of Trump, which was violent upon the environment and other people. And the reason Joe Biden has to listen to us is because we are the majority in this country. He was elected on a populist mandate for strong action and the delivery of a more people-centered economy. And the opposite is what these developments are right now. He is giving much more leverage to corporations rather than the people on the ground who are demanding better.
People around the world will wonder, because they'll think, why did Biden bomb Syria? I mean, that can't be environmentally friendly to attack countries with missiles.
Absolutely not. And, you know, the big point here is that when we talk about climate change, we're also talking about foreign relations. And if Joe Biden truly wants the age of oil to be over and for us to recover in a green way that centers our economies in a more just and equitable and sustainable way, then, the age of oil and the end of it also has to come with the end of interventions in the Middle East and the United States' long-standing militarism abroad. And that's not something that we're going to make concessions on. So it's absolutely deplorable that before delivering on the mandate that he promised to young people and people of color in this country and deliver those $2,000 checks and everything else, that he was more concerned with intervening and dropping bombs on the Syrian people. And that's something that our movement is completely against as well. Our movement never depends on the leveraged power of a few people that we call allies within Congress. The voices and the statements that are produced by certain officials come from the massive popular demands of movement. So I think what's going on in the ground right now and what I'm actually really looking forward to in this age is that, unlike the complacency that came from the general public with Obama, I think people have more of their eyes on Biden, and not only more of their eyes just on the things that he's doing wrong, but also the folks and the people in Congress, like our staunch movement allies, that have the ability to curtail all of that wrongdoing. So we really have to speak youth to power in our movements, and that's what we have been doing for the past 4 years. That's what we will continue to be doing, and make sure that those who we consider allies in Congress do call out the violent nature of U.S. politics that can ensue if we keep governing business as usual. We've been following the money from the beginning of the foundation of Sunrise Movement. We popularized and helped popularize the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, in which we would only tie ourselves to certain candidates and put in the work for them if they were ready to go to bat for regular people rather than oil corporations. And Joe Biden wasn't one of those candidates, which is why we didn't endorse him. But we knew that he would at least be leverageable more than a proto-fascist or who is advancing a police state from the presidency. And now there's no more honeymoon for Joe Biden. We're past that phase. If he wants to fulfill the FDR presidency that he promised, then he's going to have to go to bat for people that elected him, the American majority, rather than these small numbers of corporations. And that's a big task, and it's going to have to be the responsibility of movements to change the way that Joe Biden has governed for his entire political career. Our society has operated from a place of cynicism for a very long time, and it's easy to say that the problems that stand in our way are uphill battles, right? Getting Joe Biden to govern like FDR and more is going to be hard. We know that. Corporations are behind him. This is how he's always been. But what is the alternative? Defeat? Letting our families die due to the climate crisis, rising seas, intensifying hurricanes, and being okay with that because we chose to give up? We don't believe that at Sunrise Movement. And we think that if for one generation we can wage a what we call militant optimism and carry our fight to achieve what often seems impossible, that's the way to go. And that's the only alternative there is to combat all of these spiraling crises that we're facing at the moment. He can't co-opt this term of building back better if what he's doing is building back in the same ways, creating the same conditions that fueled all of these crises of economic injustice, racial injustice, and the climate crisis. It simply won't be the case. So what our movements are shaping to do or are looking forward to doing is shape the agenda of build back better to fulfill the mantle that he was actually campaigning on. And there's a lot of work to be done, for sure, as you've highlighted.
JP, thank you.
That interview with John Paul Mejia was by Afshin Ratansi on his program called Going Underground on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available at rt.com. On to Radio Havana, Cuba. In Bolivia, coup leader and subsequent president Jeanine Añez began a four-month jail term to prevent her from leaving the country while being investigated for terrorism, conspiracy, and sedition. The United States and Israel are trying to prevent cargo ships and oil tankers from entering Syrian waters. The Iranian diplomat at the United Nations says American forces currently occupying parts of Syria must immediately leave. The British government has announced an upcoming increase in nuclear weapons stockpile to prepare for future wars and to escalate the confrontation with China. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Bolivian judge Regina Santa Cruz has decreed 4 months of preventative detention for the country's former de facto president, Jeanine Añez, as well as former de facto ministers Álvaro Coimbra and Rodrigo Guzmán. Although the Attorney General's office had asked for 6 months to be decreed while the investigation is ongoing, Judge Santa Cruz considered the pre-trial detention time to be excessive. Añez and her collaborators, who led the 2019 coup against then-Bolivian President Evo Morales, are being investigated for terrorism, sedition and conspiracy. Former de facto president Jeanine Añez will serve preventative detention in the Obrajes Women's Prison, while the two former ministers will be held in the San Pedro de la Paz prison. During the hearing, which lasted more than 10 hours on Sunday, both Añez and her former ministers, Coimbra and Guzmán, were detained in an office of the Special Force Against Crime. The judge ruled that there is a high risk that Añez and the others will flee from Bolivian justice if they are released on bail. The United States and Israel are trying to prevent cargo ships and oil tankers from entering Syrian waters as part of the economic siege against the Arab country and its reconstruction process following the bloody civil war. According to political analyst Saleh Abu Issa, a senior expert in West Asia affairs, the U.S. is using the economic blockade to achieve what it failed to accomplish on the battlefield of the full-scale war. He said the U.S. had started its attacks against Syria 10 years ago, since 2011, and later, along with its allies, imposed a cruel blockade against the government and people of Syria by passing the Caesar Act in 2020. Abu Issa referred to the siege as a mechanism used by Washington, Riyadh, and Tel Aviv to undermine the Astana peace process, an initiative launched by Iran, Russia, and Turkey to find a political settlement to the Syria crisis. In comments over the weekend, Syrian and Russian officials said that the United States continues to impede the restoration of stability in the country through the imposition of economic sanctions. The Russian and Syrian Joint Coordination Committees on Repatriation of Syrian Refugees said in a joint statement, quote, "The U.S. and its allies continue, by all means, to undermine stability in Syria. All U.S. claims of willingness to provide the Syrian nation with assistance are false. These unlawful sanctions completely strangle Syria's economy." Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations says all American forces that are currently occupying parts of Syria must immediately leave the Arab country. Majid Taht Ravanchi made the remarks in an address to the United Nations Security Council, during which he emphasized that the sole solution to the crisis in Syria would be a peaceful one conforming to international law. He stressed that all foreign forces that are present in Syria without the Damascus government's approval, particularly the American troops that are occupying parts of Syria, must leave the country as soon as possible. Quote, "The Syrian people do not accept continued occupation of their soil or violation of their country's sovereignty, and the international community should not concede to it either, because it contravenes the most basic principles of international law," he said. Taht Ravanchi also strongly condemned frequent attacks by U.S. forces and Israel in Iraq and Syria, noting that such illegal measures only worsen the situation in an already tense region. In a significant development in both the defense and foreign policy arenas, the British government is reported to be planning to increase the UK's stockpile of nuclear warheads. The development was first reported by The Telegraph's deputy political editor, Lucy Fisher. Fisher was previously the defence correspondent at The Times and is highly regarded in the UK's defence and security circles. According to two experts cited by Fisher, the ramping up of the country's nuclear stockpile is not only a significant departure from its disarmament norms since the end of the Cold War, but is also indicative of the UK's desire to escalate the confrontation with China. Currently, the UK has 118 nuclear warheads, down from 500 at the height of the Cold War in the late 1970s. This development comes on the heels of the government's announcement of an £80 billion boost for the military, with a view to upgrading and preparing British forces for the, quote, "wars of the future." Adding to the country's already impressive nuclear stockpile is at the very least an indication the UK is preparing to adopt a more assertive posture on the world stage.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working pretty well at radiohc.cu, though the podcast have not been updated. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could make a donation for production cost of this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts. I am very grateful for a donation from a listener in Mendocino, California. Many thanks. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. More about the British move to increase its nuclear stockpile from 180 weapons to 260. The foreign and defense chiefs of the United States and Japan met to discuss alliances and regional challenges. North Korea harshly criticized the current U.S.-South Korea joint military drills underway. Then a brief report on the military takeover in Myanmar. NHK Japan.
Now to the latest on Britain's move to increase its nuclear weapons stockpile. In a one-on-one interview with NHK, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said his country needs the minimum credible deterrence provided by nuclear arms to deal with international threats. The UK government announced on Tuesday that it will raise the ceiling on its nuclear warhead stockpile from 180 to 260. It's part of a review of national security policies. Raab said there are fluid threats to Britain's security, namely from Iran, North Korea, and Russia. He said Britain needs to constantly adjust its position to meet evolving dangers.
But what we're not going to do is go below a level of minimum credible deterrence, whilst many others either have weapons or are seeking to obtain them.
The government also wants to increase Britain's involvement in the Indo-Pacific. It plans to deploy an aircraft carrier to the region, a move he denies being a signal to China.
It's sending a signal to all of our friends, in particular our closest allies, including Japan, that we're there as a force for good, a force for stability, and to uphold the international rules-based system.
Here in Tokyo, where the foreign and defense chiefs of Japan and the U.S. have wrapped up a high-profile meeting focused on the bilateral alliance and countering regional challenges. The two countries issued a document after the meeting expressing concern over China's maritime activities and human rights conditions in the country.
The strategic environment of the Indo-Pacific region has entered into a completely different dimension than where it used to be, and the importance of our alliance has never reached these heights.
China uses coercion and aggression to systematically erode autonomy in Hong Kong, undercut democracy in Taiwan, abuse human rights in Xinjiang and Tibet, and assert maritime claims in the South China Sea that violate international law. We will push back if necessary when China uses coercion or aggression to get its way.
The joint document says China's actions that do not meet with the existing international order are posing political, economic, military, and technical challenges to the Japan-U.S. alliance and the global community. It also expresses concern over a new Chinese law which authorizes Coast Guard vessels to use weapons in waters Beijing considers to be under its jurisdiction. The foreign and defense chiefs discussed America's commitment to the defense of Japan, including the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. Japan controls the islands. China and Taiwan claim them. The Japanese government maintains the islands are an inherent part of Japan's territory in terms of history and international law. It says there is no issue of sovereignty to be resolved over them. The two countries say they'll continue to stand against any unilateral attempt to change the status quo or undermine Japan's administration over the islands. Secretary of State Blinken told reporters that Washington has been reviewing its policy toward North Korea. He said he wants to complete the process in the coming weeks after consultations with Japan and South Korea. Blinken also said Washington has been reaching out to the North Korean government since mid-February, but it hasn't received a direct response. Turning to North Korea, the younger sister of leader Kim Jong-un has harshly criticized the ongoing joint military drills by the United States and South Korea. Kim Yo-jong's comments on Tuesday were Pyongyang's first reaction to the drills. They began March 8th and will conclude on Thursday. Kim Yo-jong had strong words for South Korean authorities in a statement published in the ruling party's newspaper. She wrote, quote, "Their idea of seeking confrontation with the compatriots in the North and hostile behavior toward the latter, which festered to be a chronic disease, have reached an incurable state." She described South Korea's explanation of drastically scaling back the drill as ridiculous, saying Pyongyang has opposed the drills but never argued about their scale or form. Kim Yo-jong threatened to end an inter-Korean agreement aimed at easing military tensions. She also gave a warning to Biden's administration, saying, quote, "If it wants to sleep in peace for the coming 4 years, it had better refrain from causing a stink at its first step," end quote. Turning now to the latest developments in Myanmar's military takeover and opposition movements. A local human rights NGO, the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, says more than 200 people have been killed since the February 1st coup. It blamed the military for targeting the general public. In the largest city, Yangon, no major protests have been reported in areas where martial law was declared this week. As security forces intensified their violent crackdown on protesters, a body of ousted lawmakers, including members of Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, released a statement on Wednesday. The group, called CRPH, announced on its own accord that it had removed all ethnic armed groups from the government's list of terrorists and unlawful organizations. A special envoy to the United Nations, appointed by the group, said the move was aimed at calling on armed groups to cooperate with the people to resist the military. The military has cut off mobile internet service, mainly in Yangon. The people are afraid that they'll face growing isolation as communication among them becomes more difficult.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 6155-7245 and 7445, or on the web at www3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.